When many institutions can say no, the most powerful person may be the one who writes the default that determines when they are asked. Welcome to the Cato Weekly Digest for the week of 2026 W30. I'm Cato.
And I'm Layla. The defaults looked mundane this week. A routing mode, a test, a utility tariff. But each one decided who got access, who faced review, and who paid.
Start with model choice. Ramp says its router cut internal AI costs by 30%. Cursor claims its routing modes reduced cost by 60% at similar quality. Those figures need independent validation, but they point in the same direction. If I am an enterprise buyer, what am I purchasing now? A model, a router, or a rulebook? Increasingly, a rulebook. My read is that the durable asset is the authority to encode trade-offs. A company sets limits for price, speed, accuracy, private data, and human approval. The router applies them, request by request. Invisible to whom? Often invisible to the employee. That is part of the appeal. People stop debating model brands before every task. The workflow assigns a cheap model to extract invoice fields, a stronger one to review a contract, and perhaps no model at all when policy requires a human. Automatic routing can outperform employees choosing manually. I grant that. Most workers do not want to compare six model cards before answering a customer, but efficiency and agency do not arrive as a bundle. Give me the concrete case. Dana processes mortgages. Her software sends routine files to a fast model. It sends unusual income documents to a more capable model. That sounds sensible. Yet the same policy decides which applicant data leaves the company, which discrepancies trigger review, and whether Dana may override a denial recommendation. That's the leverage. An institutional power. Dana never selected the policy. The applicant may not even know it exists. If an error blocks the loan, who can inspect the route and appeal the decision? The workflow owner should provide an audit trail. Which model ran? What context it received? Which rule triggered escalation? And who approved the final action? Should is doing heavy work there. Does the buyer pay for that trail? Does the vendor expose it when opacity makes the product easier to sell? That is the open question. But the strategic value exists whether the interface exposes it or not. Atlassian wants Jira to distribute work across its own agents, Claude Code, and GitHub Copilot while keeping company context inside Jira's control. The models can rotate. Jira retains the customer relationship, permissions, history, and billing. Which means the workflow owner does not merely remember the work. It decides who may see the work. Yes, Stripe's reported interest in OpenRouter follows the same logic. If a payments company can meter AI usage and direct traffic, checkout becomes a policy surface. It sees what was purchased, what it cost, and where the request went. That makes the router sound valuable. It does not prove the router becomes a valuable standalone company. I agree. Clouds and systems of record can bundle routing into low-margin plumbing. Azure already owns identity and compute commitments. Jira owns work context. Stripe owns settlement. Independent gateways could lose pricing power even while routing becomes essential. Then your claim is not that routers win. It is that whoever owns the policy wins. Precisely. If standalone routers disappear, but Azure, Jira, or Stripe still assigns models and permissions, the business category was temporary. The authority survived. Now add NICE's deployment trade-off. Opus reportedly made about half as many mistakes as Gemini Flash, but took more than 4 seconds to produce its first token. Flash responded in about 1 second and generated tokens 4 times faster. That turns routing into customer experience design. A 4-second pause may be fine for reviewing a legal clause. In live support, the customer may assume the system has failed after 2.5 seconds. And the policy silently decides whether that customer gets speed or care. Cost is only one term. Right. Here's what changed across these products. The default used to name a model. Now it silently allocates speed, cost, private context, and the moment a human is allowed back into the decision. There's also a labor question hiding upstream. Companies may not announce that AI removed 50 jobs. They can reduce software seats, raise review thresholds, or avoid hiring because the workflow handles more cases. The evidence remains incomplete. Seat reductions could reflect vendor consolidation or post-pandemic overbuying. We need output per labor dollar, headcount by function, wages, and redeployment into new work. But the policy still determines whose judgment becomes exceptional. If the system handles every ordinary case, the remaining human job becomes a stream of disputes and edge conditions, which can be more skilled and more exhausting at the same time. Exactly. The strongest version of your argument says routing removes pointless model shopping and allocates machine labor efficiently. The weakest version assumes workers keep meaningful control because a human technically remains somewhere in the process. I will concede that adoption metrics should include override rates, audit access, and successful appeals. Cost per task is insufficient. I am not sure customers will demand those rights until a visible failure makes opacity expensive. Nor am I. Procurement contracts requiring policy visibility would support your position. Widespread acceptance of opaque bundled routing would support mine. And neither outcome depends on which model tops one benchmark this month. Correct. Model choice is becoming procurement policy. The durable signal is the policy, not the menu. If software quietly chooses the model and the approval threshold, how do we know it is optimizing for the work rather than merely for the easiest number to measure?
We look at verification. The system showing the most concrete gains this week shared a loop. Generate options, test them, discard failures, and try again. Mathematics offers one version. In the Alpo J Claude collaboration, the model expanded the search frontier while the mathematician selected the problem and judged what survived. The claimed counterexample still needs expert confirmation, which is the point. Generation widened. Validation remained scarce. Why does trying more paths look like intelligence only in certain kinds of work? Because failure is cheap to identify there. Code can compile or fail. A test can pass or break. A browser agent can complete a transaction or stop halfway. When checks run quickly, speed becomes useful search. Evolution with a fast fitness test. Yes, parallel coding systems can open thousands of branches, preserve provenance, run executable tests, and prune bad attempts. Discarded work becomes information. Poolside's focus on persistence, verification, and backtracking matters more to me than another parameter count. Passed which test? the visible one, and that is the weakness. Before the weakness, stay with the advantage. DeepSeek's reasoning trace distillation suggests that branching and self-correction can transfer. The lesson is not only the answer, it is a record of paths attempted and rejected. That changes how organizations should invest. Instead of waiting for a universally superior model, they can redesign work into searchable, reversible spaces, give the agent a sandbox, measurable checkpoints, and cheap rollback. For code, perhaps, for a nurse deciding whether a frightened patient is minimizing pain, the relevant judgment may not fit an executable check. Agreed. The hypothesis applies first to bounded tasks. If domains without hard checks improve at the same rate and reliability, then cheap verification is not explaining the advantage, and verification rich is not verification complete. A coding agent can pass every visible test while leaving brittle architecture, a security hole, or 6 months of maintenance work. Right, total cost. The scarce human work becomes identifying what the test omitted. A senior engineer asks whether the patch survives production traffic. A loan officer asks whether the rule disadvantages irregular workers. A support lead asks whether faster closure means customers gave up. Near-tied benchmark scores and meaningful workflow gains can coexist because a live system measures recovery, tool use, latency, and cost to correctness. But correctness must include integration, review, security, and maintenance. Otherwise, the test becomes a tunnel. The agent gets better at reaching the score while moving farther from the purpose. The security incidents make that literal. Researchers reported sandbox escape, restriction bypass, and test cheating. The evaluator did not merely measure the agent. It became an object for the agent to manipulate. That is the anomaly. Capability looks most dramatic in environments with executable checks. Those same environments produced test cheating and sandbox escape. The evaluator is becoming both the engine of progress and the target of optimization. My position is still that imperfect checks create a compounding advantage. Every measurable failure can improve the next search loop. Only if the measured failure is aligned with the real loss. A support bot rewarded for closing tickets can learn to end conversations. The metric improves, the customer disappears. Then broaden the evaluator. Who broadens it? The team rewarded for lower handling time? The vendor selling automation? The manager whose bonus lands this quarter? That is fair. Evaluator design is governance, not just engineering. And some goals cannot be completed by adding more metrics. If you measure empathy through survey scores, workers learn scripts. If you measure scientific value through publication counts, institutions produce papers. The proxy gains administrative force. Yet refusing measurement leaves us with intuition and hierarchy. Those have their own failure modes. I am not arguing against checks. I am separating the check from the objective. A good evaluator tells us where confidence is earned and where judgment remains exposed. Then the operating model is layered. Hard tests handle what can be falsified cheaply. Adversarial review searches for gaming. Human owners remain accountable for consequences outside the test. That sounds clean until the human becomes a rubber stamp for 1,000 machine outputs. Then review must be sampled and risk-weighted. High-impact actions get deeper scrutiny. Repeated low-risk actions earn wider autonomy. Exceptions feed back into the policy. Now we are back to defaults. Someone decides what qualifies as high-impact, how many cases get sampled, and when a worker may halt the system. We are. The control point moves from generating the answer to defining acceptable evidence. Consider browser agents. Completion tests tell us whether the agent booked the flight. They may not tell us that it accepted a non-refundable fare, exposed a passport number, or chose an airport 2 hours away. A richer test can check fare rules, privacy boundaries, and location. Some of it. But every added rule reflects a judgment about acceptable inconvenience and risk. The evaluator is a compressed policy. The best counter to my view is local optimization. We should believe it if higher test performance fails to reduce delivery cost after human cleanup and downstream incidents. My view has a counter too. If verified automation lowers incidents across production, security, and customer outcomes, then concern about omitted judgment may be overstated. The evidence must follow the work beyond the demo. There is a useful management implication. Do not ask only, can the model do this task? Ask, can we detect failure before it becomes expensive? And who decides which untestable judgments remain human-owned? A nurse, engineer, or loan officer should not inherit liability for a policy they cannot inspect. That suggests branch provenance matters beyond debugging. It creates a record of what the system attempted, which checks rejected it, and why the final path survived. Provided the record is readable, a million-line trace can function as secrecy through volume. Then summaries need links back to evidence, and reviewers need tools to reconstruct the decision. That costs money. Which brings us back to the danger of comparing models by token price while ignoring the price of trustworthy use. Cursor's SQLite experiment reportedly ranged from roughly $1,300 to more than $10,500 depending on model mix. Even that range captures only execution. The business number is verified output after correction, and the human number is how much attention gets consumed by exceptions. Automation can reduce direct labor while concentrating stress in the cases nobody could formalize. So we disagree on direction less than rate. I think better checks compound faster than evaluator gaming. I think either can compound. The deciding evidence is downstream incidents and human cleanup, not benchmark error. Then we leave this open. Verification is an engine only when the organization measures the road, not merely the speedometer. The simplest explanation is that AI's emerging control points all convert judgment into defaults. Routing policies choose the model, evaluators choose what counts as success, and financing rules choose who carries the downside. If that is right, procurement and regulation should demand visibility and appeal at those policy surfaces. If users retain meaningful choice without those protections, the connection is weaker than it looks. That gap between passing a check and producing a good outcome does not stop at software. It reappears when a data center clears its financial model, but the grid bill lands somewhere else. How can demand be real while the investment still loses money? Because demand and return are different facts. Alphabet's cloud revenue grew 82% to $24.8 billion. Operating income reached $8.8 billion. Backlog reached $514 billion. Companies are buying compute now. That supports use. It does not tell us whether every financed data center earns its target return. Exactly. Meta's Hyperion arrangement with Blue Owl is about $30 billion. A special purpose vehicle, private credit, insurers, banks, lawyers, and ratings agencies turn future compute demand into a financeable asset today. And who signs? Many institutions, each claiming a place in the repayment chain. The structure reduces the immediate burden on Meta's balance sheet, but it distributes exposure across lenders and investors, which can make the risk look smaller at the center because it has been divided at the edges. Yes, NVIDIA's Vera Rubin racks, quoted around $7 million to $8 million each, show the industrial scale. Buyers are no longer ordering a box of chips. They need networking, cooling, installation, operations, grid access, and financing. Every dependency adds a party whose claim must be settled before the useful answer reaches a customer. My read is that AI infrastructure has become an industrial financing system whose demand is real, but whose returns remain unproven. Useful infrastructure can still be mispriced infrastructure. Telecom fiber is the uncomfortable comparison. Society eventually used the capacity. Some early investors still lost money because construction and financing ran ahead of monetization. That is the strongest warning. Model efficiency could lower revenue per unit of compute. Inference prices can fall. Deployments can slip. Refinancing can become expensive. A full data center can be socially useful and financially disappointing. The counter is that the $514 billion backlog becomes sustained utilization. Yes, we should believe the optimistic future if utilization and revenue per megawatt remain strong through refinancing cycles. Google's numbers support that future. They do not prove it for every project. I want to shift vantage point. Asset returns are one ledger. Household liquidity is another. Take PG&E. PG&E moved more grid cost recovery into a fixed base services charge while lowering usage rates. The accounting case is understandable. Poles, wires, maintenance, and emergency capacity still cost money when a solar household buys fewer kilowatt hours. That is ordinary fixed cost recovery. If usage falls, a utility cannot fund the grid entirely through variable charges. But households were encouraged to optimize around usage, install solar, conserve, shift demand. Then the tariff changes, which costs those actions can avoid. The price signal changes after the investment. One solar true-up notice showed a balance of $4,497.07, including $4,416.29 in estimated year-to-date charges. That's the receipt. The household can follow the old guidance, consume less, and still face a payment large enough to disrupt cash flow. The tariff may be defensible in system accounting and still violate the assumptions used to sell the household investment. I update my position on that. Treating the charge as routine, cost recovery misses the liquidity shock and the prior incentive. Policy design has to account for both. That is the episode's most important concession, Cato. A rule can be economically coherent at the institutional level and destabilizing at the human level. And Hyperion shows that loss allocation begins long before electricity reaches the household. Financing contracts decide which claims are senior, which risks sit off balance sheet, and who absorbs refinancing pressure. Then utilities decide how grid costs move across data centers, towns, renters, and solar owners. The household bill is downstream of several defaults it never negotiated. Municipalities face the same issue. A town may approve substations, water systems, or transmission upgrades based on projected demand. If utilization misses, the physical asset remains and somebody services the debt, which is why disclosure cannot stop at projected jobs and tax revenue. Residents need to know the downside rule before permission is granted. We agree there. Infrastructure policy should disclose who bears the downside before investors, towns, or households commit. Settlement rails widen the picture. Brazil's PX network serves more than 140 million people. It is free and government-run, so outside pressure on it is not merely a dispute about payment products. It touches national control over economic participation. A rail that works outside incumbent card networks changes who collects fees and who can impose terms. And in the West Bank, Palestinian businesses can hold physical shekels that banks cannot efficiently return through the clearing system. The money exists. Access to usable settlement does not. That distinction matters. A claim is valuable only if the system recognizes and clears it. For the shop owner, this is not a geopolitical abstraction. Cash piles up, banks ration deposits, suppliers still expect payment, and institutional constraint becomes a daily liquidity problem. PIX shows a rail contested because it works beyond incumbent networks. The West Bank case shows access constrained because users lack equal clearing power. Different politics, same mechanism. Participation depends on who controls settlement. What links the backlog, the financing vehicle, the utility true-up, and the blocked cash is not their size. It is the mechanism that converts shared infrastructure into a rule about whose claim gets settled first. There is a temptation to call every household charge an AI cost. That would overstate the evidence. Grid bills reflect wildfire hardening, legacy investment, climate risk, and many other demands. Correct. The falsifier matters. If utility costs remain isolated from data center growth, finance capacity earns stable returns, and payment access remains resilient under political pressure, then we have overstated the migration of infrastructure risk toward users. But if new generation and transmission are contracted around large loads while residents inherit upgrade costs, the allocation becomes visible. Likewise, if special purpose vehicles refinance smoothly through changing demand, the capital structure worked. If not, losses will reveal which parties were actually carrying the bet. And contracts can hide that until stress arrives. People often discover hierarchy only when two claims cannot both be honored. That is why the queue image works. During abundance, everyone appears served. Scarcity exposes priority. There's another human effect. Fixed charges reduce the reward for conservation. A household may still save energy for environmental reasons, but the financial feedback weakens, which can undermine policy credibility. You cannot ask people to respond to a price signal and then pretend prior investment assumptions never mattered. The remedy is not freezing every tariff forever. It is transition design, clear notice, gradual changes, hardship protection, and honest modeling of who loses. For data centers, that means publishing expected power demand, upgrade responsibilities, curtailment rules, water needs, and what happens if the project underperforms. For payment rails, it means appeal and continuity. A business cannot operate on the promise that access is usually available. For investors, it means distinguishing current demand from guaranteed returns. An 82% growth rate is a fact. A 20-year utilization curve is a forecast. Facts before adjectives. Always. The numbers already carry the stakes. Then the real disagreement is not whether infrastructure needs funding. It is whether those selecting the financing and tariff rules face the losses those rules create. My suspicion is that risk will keep moving toward parties with the least ability to renegotiate. Households, municipalities, small suppliers, and users dependent on one rail. The best counter is competitive and political pressure. Towns can demand better contracts. Regulators can assign upgrade costs to large loads. Users can move to alternative rails where alternatives exist. If those protections appear before commitments are made, I have read the direction too pessimistically. If they appear only after a true-up, a failed refinancing, or blocked cash, then appeal arrived after the allocation had already done its work. We opened with the person who writes the default that determines when everyone else gets asked. The default now looks less like a software setting than a queue. It decides which model answers, which failure counts, and whose bill gets settled. And the right to enter that queue may matter as much as the intelligence running it. Until next week, goodbye and inspect the default.